This is a special edition of Faith in Action entitled Sons of Melchizedek, where we welcome priests from the Archdiocese of Indianapolis and the Diocese of Lafayette in Indiana to tell us their vocation stories. We are so grateful to and thankful for our priests as they serve us and bring us the sacraments daily. Before we introduce today's special guest priest, we'd like to pray for you, Father. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Gracious and loving God, we thank you for the gift of our priests. Through them, we experience your presence in the sacraments. Help our priests to be strong in their vocation. Set their souls on fire with love for your people. Grant them the wisdom, understanding, and strength they need to follow in the footsteps of Jesus. We ask this through Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns as our eternal priest. Amen.
Welcome to the program. This is Gordon Smith. I am host of Sons of Melchizedek program, and we have a very special program today. I am interviewing Bishop Timothy L. Doherty of the Diocese of Lafayette in Indiana. Welcome, Bishop Doherty.
Gordon, it's good to be here.
God bless you for doing this. I appreciate it. This is a show on vocations, so we're going to try to break into a little bit of what your background is, Bishop, and we want to find out some of the things that caused you to have a priestly vocation. Kind of a funny thing that when I mentioned this to you at first, you said, well, I don't have an interesting vocation at all. And I thought, that is interesting in of itself. It is interesting that you don't think you had an interesting vocation, and yet here you are, you're Bishop of Lafayette. And I want to find out what caused you to have those. So let's talk about your early years first. Can you tell me what your background is there, please?
Sure. My background is I was born in 1950 in northern Illinois in a town called Rockford, at the time a real industrial center. And I was part of a large clan of people. My dad was one of 10. I had probably 30 or 40 first cousins by the time we moved to Ohio. But I started out at St. Pat's Church on the west side of Rockford, which was a growing place after the World War. The school eventually got to about 900 students, and it was quite the place. In third grade, Dad got a transfer over to Cleveland. We lived there for a year. Then he got transferred to Chicago, so we moved back to northern Illinois at that time. St. Pat's School was a real interesting story for me. There were Cincinnati Dominican sisters there, the full habit, of course, and a few lay teachers. It was a wonderful place to be. We were treated well as kids. I don't know how each of us felt so cared for. There were 60 in my first grade. There were 60 in the first grade across the hall, and we all felt individual attention somehow. And all of us, as we got older, would comment on this. How did those sisters do that? Of course, we didn't have the distraction of all the television and everything. I tell people TV was on from 4 to 7 p.m. every day when I was that small. So the sisters had a great effect on me. The priests were kind of funny. They were Irish Chicago kind of guys. One of the associates, Father Fitzgibbons, honest to Pete, us children thought to be a Catholic, you had to be a White Sox fan. I mean, he had us all convinced. And, you know, so we were all afraid of going to our first confession and having him ask whether we were White Sox fans or not. And I was a Braves fan at the time when they were in Milwaukee. So, but we got along well with everybody. I remember meeting our new bishop, Bishop Lane, in the first grade. I was after school for some reason having fun, and the bishop came around and I was introduced to him. So, but certainly early in my life, I had an idea of the architecture of the hierarchy of the church. I knew what bishops and cardinals and all that were. And it was a ranked organization, just like the military that my father and uncles were in. So it was easy for me to understand.
So you would be considered a baby boomer by your age, mm-hmm. and this is post-World War II, and the schools were full. That's what I'm gathering there.
Yeah.
So and how long did you stay at Rockford before you went to Cleveland?
I moved, we were halfway into third grade, and okay. We moved to Cleveland, Ohio, and moved into Our Lady of Angels Parish there, which was at the time a Franciscan parish. It was a wonderful spot. You know, in terms of things that you remember, the OLA fire had just happened in Chicago, and so we moved to Cleveland, and I'm walking in the front door of the school, and in the terrazzo floor in the entrance are the letters OLA, and that sent a chill through me, which probably didn't register till years later, but it had an effect on me. But the people there were wonderful. Everybody was wonderful.
So you had Dominicans and Franciscans at this point mm-hmm. in your life, and they had some influence on you. Any particular priest that you looked up to at the time?
You know, there was one. My parents had a priest friend that had something to do with their meeting each other and getting married. But otherwise, you know, those were the days when the priest would come around into classrooms to hand out report cards a couple times a year. So you got your report card from the hand of the priest. So you saw him not only at church or at parish festivals, but you saw them up close. And they seemed to be friendly enough. And it just was, you know, we were so immersed, I suppose, in that Catholic culture that I didn't think there was any other kind of a world, even though I knew I was in a neighborhood that was hostile to Catholics sometimes. So that was part of it.
And there was a lot of Dohertys. You had seven kids.
Yeah, total, right? Our family, there eventually were seven. But while we were in Rockford, my dad had five sisters and four brothers, and so I knew all of them, and some of them had started to have children. So it was a crowd of people at Grandma's house on Sunday.
I bet.
Kids everywhere.
I bet. So as you worked your way through grade school, you ended up in a minor seminary. Is that what we call it? Minor Seminary. Mm-hmm. That was your high school, right?
That was my high school. That was in...
And that's in Rockford.
That was in Crystal Lake.
Crystal Lake.
That's a northwest suburb of Chicago. The Franciscan province, the Black Franciscans out of Chicago, had a high school there. And most of my classmates were boarders. They came from Detroit and Chicago and Pennsylvania, people there from L.A., wherever the Franciscans had parishes. But I lived at home and always had a paper route or some after-school job. But it was a great experience there. There were Franciscan priests for most of our teachers. And, you know, it was such a small school, and we had lots of homework and languages and all of our sciences and everything. I didn't realize what a good education I had till I got to college, and college was not difficult because we had worked. I tell people that in the years I went to high school, all the breaks during the year were for you to do term papers or other projects that were due for school. I mean, there was no going skiing or going to Florida. It was... So we worked, we started in September and ended up in June, and we worked that whole time.
Except when you were delivering newspapers, and I noticed an award on the wall here. Could you explain that award, Bishop?
Yeah, about in sixth or seventh grade, I got a paper route for the Elgin Daily Courier News, and I carried papers in a day when the boys collected the money, they got new customers, you interfaced a lot with the people that were your customers. So I apparently sold enough subscriptions to get a certificate congratulating me for being a good company guy, and I'm very proud of that certificate. And when I finally turned 16, I got a job at a neighborhood grocery store, had to join a union to be able to work there. And I did that from my junior and senior year and my summer going to college.
I see. Now, at this point, you're in minor seminary. You're having a religious education. But did you think you were going to be a priest yet?
No. A lot of my vocation story has to do with my love of the mystery of God, of the story of Christ's life, and of the magnificence of creation. And I'd say this to some of my confirmation classes as I travel the diocese, that astronomy was one of my first realizations of an experience, I'll say, not just a knowledge of, but an experience of the magnificence of creation. And some people might call it a mystical experience, but suddenly, you know, I was way out there in the great beyond, way before Star Trek or Star Wars, just had a feeling for this. And part of faith, certainly part of prayer, is having a sense of awe. And that experience of the stars, I have to tell you parenthetically, on Monday and Tuesday of this week, we're Wednesday, I went out very early to get the paper before dawn, and I looked up, and I saw Orion's Belt. Now, that's part of the constellation the Hunter. I haven't seen that in 40 or 50 years, but when I looked up, I immediately knew what I was looking at, and it just helped me to celebrate that, you know, my relationship with God is a felt one through his creation. I tell people, people have other doors to the holy. Some people will have music or literature or a favorite saint. But from what I can remember, in addition to all the saints and the lovely worship and prayer customs we had, this was my experience. And it was very personal. And I felt very at home in creation. And as I tell people, as magnificent as all that stuff is out there, none of it is self-aware. Those stars don't know I'm looking at them, you know.
They're, oh, sure.
And so do we really appreciate what a gift it is to be alive and how unbelievable, it's complicated, it's wonderful, it's big, has a lot of moving parts. And
it
so
gives you a sense of awe.
It does, and I can return to that from time to time. You know, other things will grant me that now, but that was really a door that opened for me, which I loved. And as you could tell this week, I celebrated again.
And there must have been not too many lights in Lafayette at the time, because you can't see those stars as well when there's too many
that's the
ambient
surprise.
Lighting.
Yeah, looking north, the whole downtown wipes out the stars, but looking south, it was wonderful.
So at what point was that for you, though? What year?
That was probably my sophomore year, as I recall.
In high school?
In high school. Yeah, I was sitting in a class, just suddenly my mind went elsewhere, and that's where it went. It left the planet.
Well, it seems to me, like in reading your biography here, that you took off from high school and went directly into the seminary, and you were a professional student for the next 8 or 9 years?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And that was all over in Rome, right?
I went to college in Davenport, Iowa. I went to
undergrad.
I went to St. Ambrose College, and that was very formative. I have a whole spiel about what the years 1968 and 69 did to me in terms of my understanding of the world between the assassinations and the wars. But the nice thing about St. Ambrose is there was a great place to be engaged in the faith, but to be very aware of what was happening in our country and our history. The Vietnam War was going on. As a young man, I couldn't be a bystander because we are all subject to the draft. So we paid attention with intensity to things that were happening in the country and in the world. But also in the church, you know, we were still trying to absorb what the Vatican Council had been teaching. So I started college 3 years after the council ended. And, you know, so the church was in a period of change, the country. And so in terms of, you know, people have asked me to tell that story about the 60s, and a wise old priest once told a bunch of younger priests, he says, if you weren't there, I can't explain it to you. That's how active and crazy the 60s were, the late 60s, early 70s.
And to this date, you remember your draft number 151.
Mm-hmm.
That was important. I mean, you paid attention to that.
I finally met a man at a reception last week who also is my age, and he remembered his number. He had gone to Notre Dame, but he remembered his number and what that did in shaping our lives and expectations.
Sure, you checked the newspaper every time that came out, right?
It was really important, yeah.
I'm talking today to Bishop Timothy L. Doherty of the Diocese of Lafayette in Indiana. This is Gordon Smith. You're listening to the Sons of Melchizedek program. Bishop, we're going to take a short break in a minute, but when we get back, I'd like to ferret a little bit more into your college years and maybe a little bit more about the 60s. And even though you had to be there to understand it, the church was in change at the time, and I'd like to ferret that out a little bit with you, please.
Sure.
We'll be right back.
When a business is looking to expand, they say it's all about location, location, location. But what about when the church needs to expand? To stretch out and reach those fallen away, estranged from the faith, or those who simply have never heard the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then it's all about vocation, vocation, vocation. We need more people dedicated to the mission of serving the church, more priests, more deacons, more men and women of vowed service, and more lay workers willing to go into the fields. The harvest is rich, but the workers are few. Is God calling you to service? Pray on it, and while you're there, pray for more vocations. A simple request from your friends at Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back. We're interviewing today Bishop Timothy Doherty of the Diocese of Lafayette in Indiana. We're so pleased to have him as a special guest of Sons of Melchizedek program. He's explaining about his college years, his years in the minor seminary, and then at Davenport before he got to Rome. But it was the late 60s. He was a baby boomer. He still is. And that was a critical time in this country, in the church, in the politics, a lot of things that helped form him. So go on, please, Bishop.
Yeah, the 60s were quite a crucible. And so if you're going to profess faith in Christ and some loyalty to the church, you had to develop some sense of what it is that the church holds dear, but also at the time how the church was behaving in the society. And we were at war. It was a time of assassinations of presidents and of political leaders and Martin Luther King. It was very turbulent, prison riots. There were just an awful lot of things going on. One of the questions that I had as a young man was, by the time we had figured out that our entry into the Vietnam War was caused by people who basically lied to the American people, including the Secretary of Defense, that the church was not speaking out and people were dying. There was a great inequity in terms of who was being sent to the war. Overwhelmingly black and brown people were being drafted. And so there just seemed to be a sense of injustice and who's standing up for the truth. It was just as difficult time for priests and any church leadership. I remember the Bishop of Davenport at the time came over to our college and said, anybody who wants to come and talk to me about anything, I'll be in this classroom at this time. So I went, and there were about 50 of us. And he was sitting on a desk, and he wasn't sitting behind the desk. He was sitting on the desk talking to us. And at one point, somebody asked him a question, and it was probably a serious, involved, political, religious question. And he just looked at us, and he said, I don't know. I had never heard a priest or a bishop say, I don't know. And I thought, that impressed me. You could tell, here we are. This is over 50 years later. It taught me something about the church. It taught me something about leadership. And, sometimes the smartest thing and most truthful thing that we can say is, I don't know. We're living in a day and age where people don't like that. They want an answer to everything. And so that impressed me. There are times where I have to say, I don't know. And that was a formative moment for me. It's where if the bishop doesn't know, then I have to know what I think. I have to know, where do I stand? What's my opinion? Because somebody's not going to decide certain things for me. I have to be able to figure things out, whether it's a matter of faith or practicality. So that was a growth moment for me.
And as we delve into your time as bishop, which is really the last 13 years, I believe, mm-hmm. You have a lot of responsibilities. I want to thank you again for this interview, because I can't imagine what kind of weight is on your shoulders. You have people tugging at your coattails all the time, wanting this, wanting that, wanting something else, wanting an answer from you. And you have to have those answers prepared, or at least think about them. And it's a crazy world right now. And I want to thank you for all the work you put in, because I know you're pulled a lot of different directions. And really now there's more information out there. I don't know, it doesn't work anymore, because there's so many answers, and a lot of them are wrong answers.
Yeah. My last column was a reprint in our paper about, are we confused or are we just suffering from indigestion because we're trying to absorb too much information that may or may not pertain to the practical questions of our everyday living. One of the things that keeps me balanced through times of change is I like to read history and church history, in particular, the history of our diocese, the church in the United States. I refer to it as kind of if you know what an outrigger is on a canoe, it's a steadying pole that's held at length, and it keeps you from capsizing. You see these things like in the Hawaiian Islands out in the Pacific. So it steadies me in the storm. There's an expression about history, the further back you can look, the farther ahead you can see. And I said this at a parish a couple of weeks ago. They were celebrating 125th anniversary, and I said, hey, I know that you all think, before I preach the gospel, I know you think that Bishop Doherty is responsible for all the changes that have gone on in the last few years. And I got this guilty laugh from the congregation. And I said, we're in our sixth diocese here. You know, there's Quebec, Baltimore, Bardstown, Vincennes, Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, and now Lafayette. And I said, did you know in your little town there used to be two Catholic churches here, and those were ended so that you could have this parish here in Cicero? And nobody knew any of that. I said, I didn't bring the change. The changes are going on for 150 years here if we would just look up and appreciate how this is. So the point being, yes, there's lots of change in people's work life, family life, business life, but the church has never been the monolith that some people imagine that it has been, and it's been continually changing in our whole American experience.
Well, thank you for being the outrigger of guiding the people of Lafayette through treacherous waters and providing some steadiness. And thank you also for not using the word polyglot, which you used earlier with me, and I had no idea what that meant.
Yes, it means many tongues, many languages. And that also has surprised people in our state. You know, they have a perception that with the wave of Hispanic people who are a huge part of the American Catholic Church, that this is a big change. But the 1906 Synod meeting of the Diocese of Fort Wayne was published in English, Latin, German, and Polish. So there's a history of that in our state. And you look at the names of our towns, there was a French presence here for a very long time.
Sure.
Even before the United States was formally founded.
Vincennes, the original Diocese of Indiana, was a French settlement. I think four or five flags flew over Vincennes originally. Is that right?
No, you're challenging my... I can't tell you. I don't know. How's that? I don't know.
There we go. I want to talk a little bit about your encouragement for parents that might see a vocation in one of their kids and maybe also have an admonition of my own that ladies, you need to encourage your husbands to be that man that sets the example in their family and that encourages their sons or their daughters that might have a religious vocation and not ever downplay that. Could you speak to that, Bishop?
You know, I've been a priest for 47 years, and so I have many thoughts on the relationship of parents to vocations. I would say the most significant one, just from my own home life, is my parents never spoke ill of another adult, whether they're a teacher, a gas station attendant, or a priest, in front of the children.
Boy, has that changed.
And that has been a huge change where people are critical of adults, and as soon as you are criticizing another adult in front of a 4 or 5 year old, they believe they have the right also to criticize adults. And so that's a huge cultural change that we've undergone. And so that would be my first caution. I remember when I was teaching high school, we had a freshman parents' night, and I said, your first homework as parents is go tell your parents not to tell stories about the dumb things you did when you were in high school. People are shameless now about sharing, let's just say, the less shiny side of our life. Certainly, bringing a child to worship, for Catholics, making a child feel at home in any Catholic church, we used to, every now and then, rather than pass by a parish that wasn't ours, Dad would just, you know, drive in there and he said, let's go in and make a visit. So you'd go in and say 3 Hail Marys and leave, you know, or light a candle and leave.
I love that.
We felt that the Catholic Church was our church. So even when we moved to Cleveland, it wasn't like we moved off the face of the earth. We were part of a large family that we, as children, we felt a sense of welcome and ownership in it. You know, I think it's important for parents also to make some space for faith and religion. You know, depending upon a child's age, they're going to have different questions. And a child can understand more about faith than we think. Even at a very early age, children are very impressionable with the beauty of music or art, and was fascinated with the physical surroundings of churches and was exposed to those things. When, you know, talk about how young is a child really appreciate where you are. One time I was a priest for maybe a year or two, and I had helped with communion, and then I stepped out onto the side porch of the church in my alb and stole on a sunny day, and a dad was leaving early from the back of the church carrying this little tiny boy. Now, the dad's back was to me as they went out to the parking lot, but the child was looking over the dad's shoulder, looking at me, and suddenly this child shouted out, "Goodbye, God," and I felt like I was an inch tall. But that little tiny guy knew that he had been in God's house. And it was a wonderful realization for me that, you know, the people who say children don't understand things till 4, 5, 6 years old, no, not true.
They pick up on everything we do. And so, men, if you're listening out there, don't be that man that shows up for Sunday Mass in shorts and flip-flops and doesn't show the respect due to the church, to the priest that's celebrating that day. Be an example to your children and never discourage them from a priestly vocation. You know, you can encourage them to other kinds of vocations as well, but if there's a priestly vocation, we need that. One thing in my own life I've come around to thinking in a new way about is I used to think that when we prayed for foreign missionaries, we were praying for hungry kids in Africa and sending our people over to them. And that's kind of an arrogant American way of thinking about things. Really now what it is people that are priests and religious coming to our country and maybe with English as a second language, helping to instruct our people in the proper ways. Is that right, Bishop?
Yeah, we couldn't do without them. The history of priests serving in the United States is that we've only produced enough homegrown priests between 1955 and 1965. Every year before that and after that, we have supplemented the priest serving corps in this country with people from other countries. Very often, groups of immigrants will bring their own priests with them, but sometimes they won't. I want to go back to that vocation thing, not just for the men, but also for the women. As a long-experienced pastor and now bishop, we'll have certain parishes that don't allow girls to serve Mass, and they limit the girls' involvement in liturgy. And the argument will be, well, Bishop, if we're going to attract people to vocations to priesthood, we have to get these young men involved. And I said, you know, the benefit of girl servers, if we treat them with respect and like, you know, real human beings that they are, and let them know that they can make a contribution, in 25 or 30 years, they're going to be a mother of some young man. And if she was treated well by the priests, she's going to consider being encouraging of a priestly vocation. So there are all kinds of layers to this, but I'm glad for this program, and I'm glad that you're bringing up these questions.
Thank you, Bishop. We've been interviewing Bishop Timothy L. Doherty of the Diocese of Lafayette in Indiana today on the Sons of Melchizedek program.
You've been listening to a special edition of Faith in Action entitled Sons of Melchizedek. Join us again next time when we'll feature another priest from the area. If you are interested in having your priest appear on this show, please contact us at Catholic Radio Indy.